how much money would you need to buy the American dream? Not how much would you need to make in order to afford the repayments on the American dream. How much would you need to buy the house, the two cars, the family, and a basic vacation every year? I know it's not going to blow your mind to find out that these supposedly vital ingredients to a good life have gotten kind of expensive, but it has reached a tipping point. The American dream is not dead, so much as it's an extreme luxury in many parts of the country that can now cost as much as $10 million to afford. That's more than most of us will ever earn in our lifetimes before taxes, interest payments, and basic essentials like food. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but holding on to the traditional financial wisdom of what you ought to have in life is now permanently out of reach for most people. And as more Americans realize this, it's fundamentally reshaping our economy.
Whether or not to have children, it's a topic these young minds discuss and contemplate.
Aaron, his wife Celia, and their two children have lived in this parking lot outside of Seattle for the past 9 months.
Workers carry $6,000 of credit card debt, while the average American has almost $8,000 worth.
This household configuration of dual income partners living alone without children is on the rise.
So, there are 3 points to this video that are each obvious by themselves, but get really interesting or worrying when you think about them all together. The first point is that the typical American dream has gone from an affordable lifestyle that even someone with a basic job could afford to live to an extreme luxury that even professional dual-income households are struggling to keep up with. The second point is that alternative lifestyles that used to be considered extremely luxurious have become way more affordable than a cookie-cutter suburban home with a 30-year mortgage. And the third point is what happens when people are making the logical choice and picking the better life for themselves. Now, I am calling it the American dream because it looks better in the title of a YouTube video. But let's be honest, the story is the same around the world, and some places have it even worse than us. According to data from the US Fed and the US Census Bureau compiled in the Case-Shiller Index, the average cost of a home in the US is now more than 7.6 times median combined household incomes. That's now significantly higher than it was in the lead up to the global financial crisis, an economic meltdown enabled by housing speculation. If you think that's bad, spare a thought for the UK, which has lower wages but similarly priced homes, or Canadians, who, according to data compiled by Financial Samurai, have on average 10% less disposable income but live in houses 75% more expensive. New mortgage rates are also at the highest point they have been since the year 2000, when home prices were only 4 times household income. The average person, even if they have a full-time working partner, cannot reasonably afford to purchase an average home at current prices with current interest rates without paying more than half of their before-tax income in interest. That's before principal repayments on the loan, and before income tax. In reality, the average bank wouldn't even write this mortgage because it would be financially irresponsible. Now, housing is expensive. You don't need me to tell you that. But every other part of the American dream has somehow become even more expensive. The cost of a car, a basic college degree, insurance, and medical care have all outpaced inflation, which is also at decade highs. The only way to keep up with these prices is to be benefiting from them. Every chart related to your personal finances is up and to the left. But investment asset classes are up even more. The average house is now earning more than the average American in capital gains that are taxed more favorably, and the stock market continues to break new records. Adjusted for inflation, household incomes have increased by 20% since 2005, but the NASDAQ is up by 340%. People who have had time to amass assets or children who are lucky enough to open an account with the First National Bank of Mommy and Daddy are the only people left who can afford the trappings of the middle class. But this isn't yet another video telling you how financially f***ed you are. I actually have good news, which is that more young Americans than ever are opting out of the American dream as the price to buy a rundown family home can buy them a much better lifestyle by just rejecting tradition. There's one expense that has grown faster than all others, so much that it has become a status symbol even though it's technically free, and that's having children. According to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the inflation-adjusted cost of raising a child has increased by more than 50% since 2000, and some of the biggest expenses are now 250% of what they were 24 years ago. This data was collected for husband and wife families, so it averages out the cost of one partner needing to take time off work to look after children. The reason this is happening is because less people are having children. Young working professionals earn too much to be eligible for most child subsidies, but too little to really afford to raise children. The only people that can afford to have children are very wealthy people who don't care about spending thousands of dollars a year on the best preschools and paraphernalia for their child. This means that only expensive, high-end services catering to the children of affluent families can count on a reliable stream of business, so the expensive options are the only ones that last in the market. There is also a large group of people with lower incomes that still have a lot of children, but according to the US Census Bureau, that's partially why America has higher rates of child poverty than elder poverty. A study by the Tax Foundation found that married couples with children were the fastest shrinking group in middle income percentiles because people couldn't afford to raise children. The Tax Foundation is a think tank that lobbies for lower taxes and lower government spending, so they might have an agenda with this report. But the numbers don't lie. People want to have children, they just can't afford to. Because even though it was something that people just assumed they were going to do in previous generations, it became one of the most expensive luxuries in our modern world. But just as everything you need to live a normal life is becoming prohibitively expensive for normal people, previously luxurious alternatives are becoming much cheaper. Remote work has allowed a lot of young people to get a job or sometimes multiple jobs at the same time and then do them from anywhere in the world. Traveling the world full-time or living in a cheap but exotic destination was the reserve of the jet-set class just a few years ago. But now almost anybody can do it while saving more money than they can get in a major city. These so-called digital nomads have gone from a small niche group to a major component of the workforce in less than a decade. A survey conducted by the workforce intelligence firm MBO Partners and published by the Harvard Business Review found that 17.3 million American workers now describe themselves as digital nomads, representing a 150% increase since 2019 alone. In this survey, digital nomads could include anybody from the tech worker sailing around the world, submitting their code once a day via Starlink, to a traveling nurse living out of a van, to someone who simply moved to a more affordable city temporarily to work remotely. In their research, the team for HBR found that the number one reason that people were pursuing this unrooted lifestyle was because they couldn't afford a more typical way of life. And if they were going to be uncomfortable both physically and financially, they would rather be uncomfortable while seeing the world. The sacrifices that you need to make to hit the road are much smaller than they used to be too. Remote jobs are still hard to land, but they are not nearly as hard to find as they used to be. Some people in remote work heavy fields like technology, data, or media creation have even created forums about doing multiple full-time jobs at the same time to make several full-time incomes. Living in a different country has also become a lot easier. Some popular centers with budget-conscious digital nomads are safer, cleaner, and have better amenities than American cities that are unaffordable. Some countries are so welcoming to young remote workers that they have even started offering digital nomad visas to simplify the legal and tax considerations of working in another country. Even if you feel lonely and want to see your friends and family frequently, saving $2,000 a month on rent buys a lot of plane tickets on budget carriers, since airline tickets are another thing that have noticeably become cheaper while everything else is getting more expensive. There are still hardships with living abroad, but they are getting easier every day, all while the American dream is getting harder. Now, not everybody priced out of living a normal life is pursuing such an adventurous alternative. There are some people that have been able to make the best of a bad situation, but there are far more young people across the world who are just giving up. In a time when the average American can't afford an unexpected $1,000 expense, luxury good companies selling $5,000 handbags or $10,000 watches are making record profits. This is because of a phenomenon known as doom spending. If you have worked hard in school, landed a good job, worked for 10 years, and are no closer to owning a home of your own, it's reasonable to want to see some kind of reward for all of your hard work. If you can't afford a sensible purchase to treat yourself, you could at least buy something that makes it look like you have some kind of financial stability in your life. It's not logical, but these companies don't make billions of dollars selling $2,000 shoes by appealing to logic. Doom spending is all a part of a bigger trend of people just giving up. In countries like China, where competition for housing and other essentials is even worse than here in America, there is a lying down movement. Young people are not going to work or school and are lying flat all day playing video games and relaxing. The trend was such a threat to the country that the government banned the term on all social media. And that might be the most important part of the dying American dream. What happens when everybody gives up on it? The American dream only works if most people believe in it to keep the system going. Maybe the boomers had it coming as they voted for policies that benefited them above their children, and now their children don't want to keep their system going. But I am sorry to tell you that most boomers are going to be dead before this really becomes a problem. It's hard for Americans to stop paying tax if they go and work in a different country, because we are one of the only countries in the world that still taxes its citizens even if they live abroad. But for other countries, losing workers who are moving elsewhere for a better life has already become a major drain on the systems that are funding their aging populations. Even if young Americans are trapped by Uncle Sam, they may not pay him as much. To be comfortable in a city like San Francisco, where the median house price is almost $1.3 million according to Zillow, experts estimate that you need an income of around $300,000 to live a comfortable middle-class lifestyle, if it could be called that. To sustainably fund that level of income in retirement, you would need invested assets of around $8 million outside your primary residence. The federal tax and FICA on that income for a single filer is $87,000 combined, but people live in San Francisco because they can earn that much in the area. But more people in these high-end jobs are willing to take a pay cut to work remotely in cheaper American cities, or a cheaper country. Google cut some of its workers' pay by 25%. And some of its workers were happy to accept it because they could work from somewhere that was four times cheaper. The federal tax and FICA on a salary of $225,000 is only $59,000. Which means after state taxes, this remote worker would only be really taking home $35,000 less every year. But the tax system misses out on about the same amount. But when even these workers at the very top end of the labor market can't earn enough with their work to catch up to other people, you can't really blame them for giving up on the American dream. But all of this might just be part of a natural cycle that has been happening for hundreds of years. The average age of a public company CEO is now 58 years old. The average director is 63. The average member of Congress is over 60. And the only reason the incoming Senate isn't the oldest ever elected is because so many of its members are dying in power, pulling down the calculation. If Donald Trump serves his entire term, he will be the oldest president in history, after replacing the oldest president in history. We are not alone. The leaders of the two most populous countries in the world, India and China, are also 74 and 71 respectively. The average person living in the world today is, on average, ruled over by someone 40 years older than them, and it all happened because of a few small demographic changes. So how the fuck did old people take over the world?
Ladies and gentlemen, President Putin.
President Putin.
You can beat President Putin.
They say a wall is medieval. Well, so is a wheel. A wheel is older than a wall.
And a string of...
Utilities being treated fairly. Charlie. Charlie, I'm so used to
it. Just say I.
Up until 2020, baby boomers were the largest generation in America by a significant margin. And as they moved through their lives, they became a significant and highly politically active voting bloc that could almost single-handedly dictate the policies of the government. When they were young, they could vote for free education and strong social support. When they started entering the workforce, they voted for worker protections, affordable housing, and policies to help raise children. When they got a little bit further in their careers, they owned their homes, they wanted lower taxes, good investment returns, and retirement opportunities. The inconvenient side effect was that meant worker protections, free education, and affordable housing became less of a priority for everybody else that came after them. David Willett, who is currently a member of the British House of Lords, first popularized this idea in his book, The Pinch: How Baby Boomers Took Their Children's Fortune. Willits is a politician, demographer, and a baby boomer himself, so his book is definitely worth checking out, so I will leave a link to it in the description. But the thing is, the baby boom wasn't enough to get us to where we are today all by itself. Human populations have boomed and bust throughout our entire history. Plagues, wars, famines, and natural disasters have made some generations bigger than others for thousands of years, and never before has so much power been held in the hands of the elderly. In the past, being part of a large generational cohort would actually be a disadvantage because if you had more peers, that means more competition for resources and jobs. So there is something more going on here. Baby boomers and the silent generation were the largest cohort of their time period. But that time period just so happened to be the most intense period of wealth creation in human history. After the Second World War, widespread industrialization, the automation of domestic chores, women entering the workforce, the adoption of global trade, and modern finance made global, and more specifically, American productivity go fucking parabolic. The world is hundreds of times wealthier today than it was in the 1950s, and baby boomers have been able to capitalize on that for their entire lives with their heavy sway on politics. Having policy tailor-made to suit their needs in their specific stage of life during the largest creation of wealth ever allowed baby boomers to amass the largest generational fortune in history. And as they have grown older, that wealth has allowed them to turn that wealth into even more influence. But eventually, that power will be lost, making way for the next generation in line. Even if they won't give up their seats willingly, there is always the inevitability of death to even the playing field. Right? Apple, Microsoft, Google, Sun Microsystems, the Java programming language, and the internet itself all have one thing in common. They are some of the biggest technology companies or systems in the world, sure. But they were all founded, created, or managed by people born in the year 1955. Now, to be fair, Eric Schmidt didn't technically found Google, but he probably had just as big of a role into turning it into what it is today as Larry and Sergey, and he has made billions of dollars in the process. If you want to be president, you should go back a little bit further. Three of the five living presidents were born within 6 months of one another in the year 1946. Now, with such a small sample size and a healthy mix of selection bias, coincidences like this do happen. But people like Malcolm Gladwell have pointed out that this statistical anomaly demonstrates the power of being born in the right time. His book Outliers is one we have referenced on the channel before, and is also definitely worth a read because it provides a lot of insights into how a small bit of luck can cause fundamental differences in outcomes. For boomers, it was a perfect combination of being exposed to new technologies that would go on to change the world and create some of the most valuable businesses in history, and not having that much competition yet. This wasn't just true for founding tech companies and ruling the free world either. Being born in the right place at the right time has helped the oldest people in the world today build up wealth in smaller but arguably more important ways as well. The most obvious factor is housing. Homes in America have never been more unaffordable compared to household incomes, and older generations that have had decades to build up equity in their home or maybe even some investment properties are benefiting from this home price appreciation instead of being crushed by it. Even accounting for the higher interest rates older generations paid on their mortgages, their home ownership rate was much higher than the generations that came after them because the barriers to entry for home ownership were much lower. Today, the gerontocracy is also working to secure that advantage in a slightly less obvious way. According to public records collected by Zipia, the average age of a city council member in America is 52 years old. Now, that's not quite Congress numbers just yet. But remember that city council is often seen as the first step in a political career. So for every 20-something hotshot, there is a real-life Councilman Milton.
Councilman Milton was first elected as a city councilor in 1948 as a member of the Dixiecrat Party. Their platform? Deintegrate baseball.
City councils don't pull the levers of global power like Congress does, but your local elected representatives probably have more influence over your life than the big dogs in Washington. In most municipalities across the country, they influence schooling, local amenities, and most importantly, zoning. These people have the power to radically influence home prices in their cities by allowing for higher density housing or by opening up new areas for development, but across the country, they choose not to. Now, even if the people sitting on these councils are spring chickens compared to other areas of government, the people actually engaged with them are not. According to the National Civic League, only 15-27% of Americans vote in local elections. And of those who do, elderly homeowners are massively overrepresented. According to the same report, those 65 and above are 7 times more likely to vote in local elections than voters aged 18-34. Even local politicians need to listen to their voters. Demographically, based on the people who watch these videos, almost none of you would know who sits on your city council, or even what their policies are, which is a shame because they wield an incredible amount of power, and they are where average people have the best chance at making a real difference. If you have genuinely ever been to a city council meeting or even voted in a local election, comment below and I will take your word for it and bestow you with a useless heart emoji. At least until I get tired and stop reading the comments. Anyway, elderly people have voted for people who will keep their homes valuable, which tends to be more elderly people helping to cement the gerontocracy from the ground floor. So, elderly people were influential at the right time to get rich, and then they used that wealth to buy even more influence. It's a pretty simple cycle. But there is still one thing that doesn't quite add up. there are countries beyond the Great Gulf of America that didn't strike it rich in the second half of the 20th century. Their baby boomers lived tough lives, and even if they were from a country where they could vote, they wouldn't be influencing the economy of a massively wealthy country, shaping it to their will to work for them. They would be voting for the party least likely to take away their basic farm. This is a broad generalization, of course, but it's hard to overstate just how fortunate the USA has been over the last 70 years. There is a graph that is honestly kind of haunting. This is life expectancy at birth for the average global citizen over the last 100 years. There are two noticeable dips, one small one which was caused by COVID-19, and this much larger one from 60 years ago. You might think this was from World War II, but those numbers aren't actually captured on this graph because records were too unreliable from back then. This two-year global dip in life expectancy was caused exclusively by China's Great Leap Forward, an economic plan that was so bad it caused mass starvation and so many casualties it noticeably moved global averages. If American boomers were in the right place at the right time, this was the exact opposite of that. Instead of going on to found a tech company, you would be lucky to make it to your first birthday. The point here is that even still, China is today largely ruled by elderly people. And that's because of the final and most crucial ingredient, inequality. Baby boomers were not only the wealthiest generation in history, they were also the most unequal. Now, before we all go and seize the means of production, it's important to remember that a lot of this inequality was caused by the rich getting richer, even when the poor were getting richer too. The life of a poor boomer was significantly better than the life of a poor person in the 19th century. But the gap between rich and poor grew much more as people built fortunes previously impossible. This means that the world isn't really ruled by boomers, it's ruled by rich boomers. They were just the first group to grab their seats at the table. In China, they just happened to open up conveniently as baby boomers were in key government positions to effectively install their own unique brand of capitalism that unsurprisingly involved making themselves and their close comrades wealthy before anybody else. In fact, even in America, wealth is a big decider of even being around to rule at all. Average life expectancy is way up, and it's continuing to rise, but it's mainly been caused by drops in infant mortality and increases in the lifespan of wealthy people. According to a study published by the National Library of Medicine, the gap in life expectancy between the poorest 1% and the richest 1% was more than 14 years. That's greater than the difference in life expectancy between America and Afghanistan. The study also found that this gap was widening as health technology, diet, and lifestyle advances were resulting in wealthy people living longer, while most of the population was relatively stagnant, especially if they had worked in physical careers. To become an old politician, you first have to become old, and the best way to do that is to stop being poor. The rapid increase in life expectancy has meant that once people get into these positions of power, they are sticking around a lot longer than they normally would have. And if nobody is moving out of these positions, it makes it harder for younger people to move into them. Now, that's most obvious in photos like this, but it's probably an even more serious problem for regular workers around the world who can't move up in the corporate ladder because senior positions are packed with rusted-on executives. Older workers know that it's a lot harder for them to find a new job with a new company, and it's also a lot harder for them to lose their job in the first place. In America, age is a protected class that can't be discriminated against. But only for old people. The law only protects people over the age of 40. Young people are fair game. This has contributed to a trend in the job market where the only way to really increase your position and compensation is to job hop, because even if companies wanted to reward staff loyalty, most of those benefits would go to the boomers. Now, to be fair, some of these people are extremely competent. A decades-long career will give people a lot of valuable experience, valuable connections, and a valuable reputation. What's more is that the old gripe about old bosses making 3 times your salary while being unable to work their emails is still true in certain circumstances. But even really old people today have been exposed to technology for most of their careers now, so they are not as behind as the elderly people from a decade ago. And none of this should matter anyway, right? Because even if old people do rule the world, eventually we will be those old people, right? Wrong. First off, it's not ideal to have a system where people are just willing to get old enough to finally get some power, and this shift is already happening. The demographic conditions that made this possible in the first place means that as the current rulers die, they are likely to be replaced with much younger candidates. Elderly people have a lot of tools to cling on to power, but as their poorer peers die off, they are losing their demographic might, This hasn't impacted authoritarian states, because once those people gain power, the will of the people isn't going to compel them to give it up. But in 2024, for the first time in decades, democratically elected leaders around the world actually got younger. This was helped by the fact that almost all incumbent leaders did poorly in last year's elections, and opposition leaders are generally younger, but it also marks a trend in younger voters having more influence over who represents them. So, if you are 40-something waiting to inherit the world, the bad news is that, just like the rest of your life, you are probably going to be skipped over. But the good news is that might be a small price to pay to unseat the gerontocracy. The exception to this global trend was here in America. Now, there is one place where power has been accumulated in the hands of the elderly faster than ever. This might come as a shock to you, but big companies are getting bigger. Rich people are getting richer, and vital resources like housing, business equity, food, and even water are now owned by a smaller share of people than ever before. Groundbreaking journalism, I know. But what most people don't realize is just how concentrated this has really become. Private equity now controls as much as 20% of the entire US economy. Top index funds now own 20 to 30% of all major companies listed in America, and even good old-fashioned fraud is getting bigger and more concentrated. And who can blame them? Economies of scale have encouraged businesses to scale markets, responded to too big to fail by becoming too big to fail. But what does this actually mean for regular people? There is the moral argument that so many resources being controlled by such a small few is, you know, unfair. But let's be honest, you've already made up your mind on that, and no YouTube video is going to change it one way or the other. Instead, what actually matters here is how much further this can go, and what happens to markets when these people have nobody left to sell to but themselves.
The last quarter you were able to buy, it looks like, a little bit more than 1,500 homes for $656 million.
These investment companies, they want to make money. That's what they're there for.
Outrageous is your tax dollars are helping Wall Street buy up single-family homes. You're subsidizing Wall Street.
Water Asset Management is a Wall Street investment firm with offices inside this building in New York City.
That as water becomes scarce, Wall Street sees profits.
Elon Musk, the world's richest person, is now the first person to have a net worth surpassing $400 billion.
Private equity has become the boogeyman of finance, just like hedge funds were in the 2010s, and sometimes for a good reason. Average people have been told to hate them, insufferable Wharton grads want to intern with them, and the industry is making more billionaires than oil, real estate, and even technology. The question is, are they creating value or just extracting it? These alternative investments used to be exactly that, alternatives. But the private equity market has changed in just the last 15 years from a small niche that was popular with a select few families to one of the biggest asset holders in the world. Because private equity is private, it can be hard to accurately estimate just how much capital is controlled by these firms. But a report published by the management consulting firm McKinsey & Company estimated that it was over $13 trillion as of June of last year. Given general market conditions and fundraising, it's likely to be even higher now. Now, there is nothing actually that special about private equity. It really just means any investment made into a business or security that is not listed on public markets. So if you invest $1,000 in your brother's farmer's market stall, you are technically a private equity investor. So, you know, make sure to slap it on the LinkedIn profile. So the reason that private equity got so big so quickly has nothing to do with it being an amazing investment or anything silly like that. It's purely the result of a financial system that has become too concentrated. The American economy, finance, and business activity are all much bigger than they were in the 1990s, but the number of publicly listed companies has actually gone way down since then. In fact, it's almost halved in the same time the economy has tripled in size. Now, one big reason for there being less publicly listed companies is simply because bigger companies have been acquiring smaller companies at record rates, making for a more concentrated business environment with fewer companies overall, which is, you know, the whole point of this video. But we will actually get to the consolidation later. There are also fewer companies IPOing in the first place, because there really is no need to anymore. Companies list themselves on stock exchanges to raise money from the public, hence why it's called an initial public offering. But the general public just doesn't have that much money anymore. The wealthiest 10% of Americans now own 93% of all publicly listed stocks. The vast majority of capital flowing into public stock markets comes from people or institutions that are rich enough to invest in private equity, so the regulatory and reporting burden of being a public company just simply isn't worth it to get access to 90% of people who all collectively own just 7% of the market. that 93% of stock ownership is largely held through retirement accounts, which are handled by funds which can invest into private equity as well. So for most companies, it just doesn't make sense to go public anymore. Now, all right, so what? People have slightly fewer options to ape their life savings into on Robinhood. Well, apart from that, this trend, which has only really been going on for 15 years at this point, is really causing a lot of problems and costing you a lot more than you realize. The first issue that doesn't get nearly enough attention is how they have created micromonopolies. When you think of monopolies, you are probably going to think of giant companies that own entire markets everywhere across the world. Like, well, you know, YouTube. But a much more common type of monopoly has started to become a bigger problem. These are small, local monopolies. One of the hottest new private equity investments has become youth sports leagues. Little League is a great investment because firms can buy up all the sports in a local area and create a monopoly on competitive team activities. And nobody wants to be the parent that denies their child the opportunity to go and touch grass with their friends. According to a report by the Aspen Institute, these local leagues are collectively a $30 billion industry, and they are becoming more expensive as they are consolidated by private equity firms. Now, this is just one particularly scummy example, but creating local monopolies is just a good business strategy. It's not technically legal, but the Federal Trade Commission just doesn't have the manpower to identify and enforce these thousands of local issues when they don't even really have the resources to go after the most obvious monopolies. These subtle consolidations have changed how and where we spend our money, but it has had a much more serious impact on how we earn our money. Another major problem with a lot of businesses being owned by a very small group of investment firms is that it makes it really hard to see what is actually happening in our own economy. Public companies have to release regular financial statements, and their market value is updated every microsecond as their stock is traded. As more of the market is held by a smaller group of investment firms, it gets harder to tell how these businesses are performing and how they are being run. John Coates, a professor of law and economics at Harvard, recently released a book called The Problem of 12, When a Few Financial Institutions Control Everything, which addressed exactly this problem. Specifically, he mentions that pension funds have found private equity very attractive, and since most pension funds are investing on behalf of regular people, it can be very difficult for those people to see how their money is being used since there are two financial institutions between them and the business they are actually investing in. Coates also speaks about the concentration of capital in index funds like Vanguard, BlackRock, and State Street. He doesn't highlight the usual criticism, like Larry Fink being a lizard man that secretly controls the global economy. But he does raise the issue that the way these financial products invest money makes normal price discovery much harder and also incentivizes getting more concentrated. Something like Vanguard's VOO ETF just mindlessly takes investor money and puts it directly into the weighted average of the 505 stocks that make up the S&P 500. And yes, there are actually 505 stocks in the S&P 500 because some companies list Class A and B shares. Finance bros aren't very good at naming things. This means that a large share of investors are just investing in whatever has the most investors, which has just helped contribute to immense valuations of companies at the top of the market. The amount of investment capital concentrated through these investment managers means that they now have significant influence over company shareholder votes, and new products like ESG or green ETFs can have more influence over board decisions than they really should have. There will be a link in the description below to that book if you are interested in reading the whole thing. Though you should know it was written for MBA students at Harvard, so it is a little bit dense. He also gave a half-hour interview just last month available here on YouTube, which is also worth checking out. Another big problem is corporate debt. Most of the biggest private equity firms in the world use what's called a leveraged buyout. This is where they will buy a whole lot of companies, get those companies to take out big loans, and then use the borrowed money to pay themselves back so that they can go and buy even more companies. This normally involves a lot of cost cutting in the business so they can make their repayments. But on a wider scale, it's contributed to the record levels of corporate debt that we have in America today, which, as a percent of GDP, was only higher during the first wave of PPP loans, and just after the global financial crisis. Businesses always want to get more concentrated. It's the natural order that big businesses will acquire little businesses or put them out of work. The rise of private equity, the proliferation of passive index funds, low interest rates, and the flaccid approach of regulators has only made this natural process much faster. But this still isn't the worst part. Corporate concentration has made finding competitive job opportunities extremely difficult, especially for people in smaller communities that have had local businesses quietly rolled up by large investment funds. The best way to get a higher salary as a worker is to switch jobs for better opportunities. But if you are a plumber and all of the plumbing businesses in the local area are owned by the same holding company, you aren't going to be able to negotiate like you would with competing businesses. Now, if you think you could get around this problem by starting a business of your own, well, actually it gets even worse. In an article published by the Washington Post, Lillian Salerno, a healthcare entrepreneur, spoke about her difficulty in bringing a new, safer medical syringe to the market because businesses up and down the supply chain had become highly consolidated, so they didn't want to work with a potential competitor even if her product would have been better for patients. This is technically anti-competitive practice, but again, regulators are understaffed and underfunded. It's even worse in highly scalable industries like technology. The most important thing that early stage investors now look for in startup companies is an exit strategy, which is just business speak for who is going to buy this company if it's successful. Those buyers are either a few of the industry top players or a private equity firm. The result of this is that only companies with the highest potential to scale and the best opportunity for acquisition actually get funded, which is why places like Silicon Valley have gone from making technology to solve the world's problems to writing algorithms to keep you watching your phone for an extra 20 seconds a day. A blog post written by Ross Bears, who is ironically the president of a venture capital firm, called this the stagnant pool of American entrepreneurship. If you wanted to start a company tomorrow, you probably wouldn't know where to start, especially if you had to go and raise capital from professional investors. There are programs like Y Combinator that incubate early stage companies, but access to these programs is highly competitive. The people that have the connections and experience to get these businesses started also know that the best way to run these businesses is to just build it so a bigger business comes along and buys it. The people that have felt this the worst are the tech bros. An entire generation of people were told that if they just learned to code, they would have a stable career for life. In the coming decades, the wealthiest generation in history will die. It's an unfortunate, albeit inevitable, fact of life, but baby boomers will eventually go extinct, and they will pass down over $90 trillion to the next generation within America alone. This much money could fix a lot of problems like student debt, unaffordable housing, inadequate retirement savings, and record credit card debt. But don't get too excited just yet, because at best, the great wealth transfer is a financial illusion, and it could actually just end up making things worse.
This is a setup. A warning of the ugliness to come. The greatest wealth transfer in history is here with familiar rich winners.
The transfer of wealth is underway. As we speak, baby boomers are leaving an estimated $70 trillion to millennial and Gen X heirs.
Baby boomers are the wealthiest generation in history. In America, they control half of the nation's wealth, according to the 2024 wealth report prepared by the property management company Knight Frank. Other sources estimate that baby boomers only hold a mere $78 trillion in assets. That slight difference of $12 trillion is due to what you really define as wealth, and that slight difference in opinion is more than the collective wealth of half the planet. Regardless of the exact methodology used to calculate generational wealth, they all agree on one thing. Baby boomers are the kings, and everybody else has been holding on to whatever is left over. That concentration of wealth has, according to many, come at the expense of younger generations who are now poorer than their parents were at the same age. So that means when life finds a way and this wealth is passed down, it should fix these generational issues, right? Wrong. Counting on an inheritance to fix your own personal finances is a terrible idea. According to a survey by the investment intelligence firm Natixis, 70% of young people expect to get an inheritance, but only 40% of their parents actually plan on leaving one. This means individually, 30% of the young adult population is going to have their financial plans ruined late in their careers when there isn't much time left to make up for it. Okay, so waiting on an inheritance is a dumb thing to do as an individual, but counting on the great wealth transfer globally is just plain irresponsible for three simple reasons. The first is that not all wealth is created equal. $7.4 trillion of the $90 trillion total are held in private businesses, according to data from the Fed. Small operations like HVAC, roofing, machining, mortgage brokering, medical practices, and repair businesses number in the millions across America, but putting a value on them can be extremely tricky. The Fed took estimated EBITDA for these companies, which takes the earnings of a business before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, and then multiplies that by an industry standard valuation multiple. If you own a small business that makes $200,000 per year before these other costs, and you operate in an industry like machinery with an industry EBITDA multiple value of 5, then congratulations, your business is worth $1 million. This is an imprecise art. And naturally, a business is only worth as much as someone is willing to pay for it, which will only cause a problem when all of these boomer-owned businesses get passed down to the next generation. According to the American Medical Association, 49.1% of physicians currently work in practices where the owner is themselves a doctor. That was down significantly since the start of the pandemic, and many of those left are owned by doctors that have had time to get the experience, clientele, and capital necessary to go into business for themselves. If they retire or die, their business doesn't have any value to their children unless they themselves are also doctors in the same field of medicine, an exceedingly rare occurrence. Millions of other owner-operator businesses will close their doors before they can be passed down to younger generations. Now, this is a bigger problem than some trust fund babies not getting handed a free business. If these businesses disappear, it will not only take their services out of the market, it will also stop new entrants into the job market from getting apprenticeships to learn the trades that are already in desperately short supply. But in crisis comes opportunity. The first group that is actually benefiting from the great wealth transfer are investment firms that are buying up these small firms for pennies on the dollar from owner-operators who just want a bit of extra cash before they retire. In a process called rolling up, private equity firms are buying dozens of small businesses and then merging them into one more efficient business that can hire cheaper employees to service the clients of all the old businesses. Sites like BizBuySell, BizQuest, and BusinessBroker.net have become the eBay for small businesses, largely listing businesses owned by retiring baby boomers who are hoping to get something rather than just shutting them down. There is one other problem with all this private business wealth too. The 50 largest private companies in America are all almost exclusively owned by baby boomers. Without the financials of these private companies, putting an accurate value on them is almost impossible. But based on comparables, these top 50 are collectively worth an estimated $2 trillion, conservatively. So, almost half of the wealth in this asset class is just 50 companies. Unless your family name is Bloomberg, Mars, or Coke, the value of the boomers' private companies is not something that is going to impact your life. But that's only one small part of the great wealth transfer. Boomers reportedly own $16.9 trillion in durables and other assets ranging from rusty old home appliances to motor yachts. Some of these goods could be sold by a beneficiary, but a lot of this paper wealth is, in reality, going to end up being a financial burden to maintain if it's not just simply disposed of. Rounding out the wealth that might not do much good to the next generation, pension plans have been calculated on what they are worth to the boomers themselves based on assessing how much money someone would need to replace that cash flow. A pension that pays out $50,000 a year to a retiree could have an on-paper future value of $1 million. But that doesn't mean that a beneficiary is going to receive $1 million when their parents die. So with that, the great wealth transfer has already been cut in half. But that still leaves $40 trillion in cash, equities, and most importantly, housing that is going to be passed down in the coming years, and that's gonna fix a few things, right? Baby boomers' second largest asset class is their homes and investment properties. The generation owns almost as much real estate as the Generation X and Millennials combined, and controlling this much of the market has caused problems for everybody else. According to a survey conducted by the real estate firm Redfin, about half of homeowners and renters said they have periodically struggled this year to afford their mortgage payment or rent as rates have increased and have been passed along to the people on the bottom of the housing ladder. The survey also found that to keep up with payments, some homeowners and renters had resorted to selling their belongings, picking up overtime shifts, canceling vacations, working a second job, and even skipping meals to keep up with their payments. Housing has simply become a major expense for everyone, except for those who have had the opportunity to purchase a home when they were affordable and the time to pay their mortgage off in full. The great wealth transfer of housing on the surface looks like a ghoulish, albeit pragmatic, solution to this problem for two simple reasons. The first is that it could provide millions of people with a house of their own to live in. The second reason is that even if you receive a home as an inheritance that you don't want to live in, you can just sell it, which is good for you and good for the market because it provides supply at a time when almost nobody wants to sell their home. So, what's the problem then? Well, again, less housing than you would expect is actually going to be passed down. A study published by the National Library of Medicine has found that a majority of lifetime healthcare costs for the average person happens after they turn 65. This is an immediate problem, because according to a study by the health research organization KFF, only half of people over 65 have anything saved to pay for healthcare costs in retirement, and the overwhelming majority of adults won't have enough money to pay for senior living care, which is now estimated to be over $100,000 per year. Medicare, which is the government-provided health insurance program for seniors, does not support senior living. So, many seniors will add a Medicare Advantage plan, which is an additional out-of-pocket expense. So, housing will be handed down, but it's primarily going to be handed down to reverse mortgage companies or sold to cover spiraling senior living costs. According to Freddie Mac, the total value of cash-out refinances and second mortgages has already doubled since 2019, as even people who do own their own home have trouble keeping up. So far, the Great Wealth Transfer is going to consolidate small businesses, financialize homes even further, drive up medical costs, strain government services, and increase household debt. But there is still hope. There is one asset class left, and it's the biggest of them all. Baby boomers hold on to more equities and fixed income securities like stocks and bonds than millennials have between all of their assets combined. But when you think about it, that doesn't really make sense. For most people, their biggest asset is their home. Participation in the stock market is at record highs thanks to investment vehicles like 401ks and IRAs, as well as technologies that make investing easier like cheap online brokerages. According to the Fed survey of consumer finances, 58% of households owned stock in 2023. Which is a good thing, but it's still lower than the 65% of households that own their own home. Part of this can be explained by people buying stocks because they simply can't afford housing, but that's only a minor factor. This class of assets will actually be handed down in the Great Wealth Transfer, but it doesn't belong to normal people. Despite record participation in the market, the richest 10% of Americans now own 93% of stocks. The bottom 50% of Americans own just 1%. Most shockingly of all, though, the stock market inequality is even more severe amongst baby boomers. Just Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Steve Ballmer, Larry Ellison, Michael Dell, Jensen Huang, and the three surviving Walmart heirs own roughly $1.9 trillion worth of stocks, or 10% of all the equities within their generation. The remaining 70 million baby boomers own the 90% that these 10 people have left behind. The good news for the people in line to inherit a majority of this wealth is that they won't need to wait for it. A New York Times article detailing the way that this wealth is being transferred has found that most of the advantages of the Great Wealth Transfer have already been handed to the people in line to receive it. A growing trend of giving while living means that children from wealthy families with the financial means to maintain their wealth until their death are already getting their college paid for, assistance with buying their first home, and cash to cover the cost of raising their own children. According to a survey from the UK, nearly 80% of children enrolled in the country's private schools had at least part of their fees paid for by their grandparents. If you are in a financial situation where you need the Great Wealth Transfer to help you out, the Great Wealth Transfer probably isn't going to help you.